Hallo und willkommen zu einer weiteren Folge des Media Lab Innovation Podcasts. Ich bin Pia, ich bin Programmmanagerin im Media Lab Bayern und euer Host in dieser Folge. Wenn wir über digitale Geschäftsmodelle reden, geht es dabei ja oft um Plattformen und Plattformmodelle, also Facebook, Google und so weiter. Für Journalistinnen und Journalisten werden solche Modelle jetzt noch einmal interessanter und das liegt zu einem großen Teil daran, dass die Plattform Substack so erfolgreich ist. Substack bietet eigentlich nur in Anführungszeichen eine einfache Möglichkeit, Newsletter zu versenden und sich dafür bezahlen zu lassen. Trotzdem haben sie in den USA ein paar echt hochkarätige Namen dazu gebracht, ihre sicheren Angestelltenjobs zu verlassen oder zumindest zu ergänzen. Zuletzt zum Beispiel den Tech-Journalisten Casey Newton oder die Soziologin und Autorin Zeynep Tufekci. Doch was genau macht die Plattform so attraktiv und was können etablierte Medienunternehmen davon lernen? Um darüber zu sprechen, habe ich heute einen der Gründer von Substack zu Gast, nämlich Hamish McKenzie. Und um ihm alle Fragen stellen zu können, wechseln wir jetzt auf Englisch. Hamish, welcome to our podcast. I'm so excited to meet you and to talk to you today about business models. To start us off, could you just give us a quick introduction into what Substack is? Just in case somebody in the audience hasn't heard of it yet.
Well, Substack is a subscription publishing platform. At its core, we make it simple for a writer to start an independent writing business. You can make a newsletter / website and publish your work there and get paid through subscriptions by your readers.
That sounds great. We have heard a lot about Substack, about the fact that Substack is sort of unbundling the news. This is, of course, a very different approach from traditional media companies, since they always sort of set out to try and offer the best bundle. In your opinion, does that have merits too, or does it seem completely anachronistic trying to offer a bundle of news?
I think the New York Times is a pretty good example of a bundle working pretty well. So I don't think it's anachronistic, and I think we're kind of like constantly in a state of bundling and unbundling and then rebundling. And I think we'll throughout history just see these moments. And Substack is a part of the ecosystem that is involved in unbundling. But in the future, I think there will be bundles arising on Substack too.
Yes, there are some attempts of rebundling on Substack as well, right? There is the Everything Bundle. Could you just go a little bit more into detail? Like, what are your thoughts on that?
At the moment, I think it's kind of very early days for the development of the Substack ecosystem, which is all these writers publishing directly for their audiences. They control those relationships. And for the most part, for the vast majority, it's each publication is like an island. And it's got its own rules and its own population. But as the network grows and develops, I think we're going to see more cooperation between these islands, more communication between these islands. And so we are starting to see some very early moves by the likes of the Everything Bundle or the Dispatch, which is a kind of a publication covering politics in the United States. And that is basically a team of people who decide to get their newsletters together and put them under a single umbrella. And they can operate like mini networks themselves. At the moment, we have not really built much tooling to facilitate that. The Everything Bundle is a bit of a pilot, and those features are not widely available. But we are interested in exploring ways to help writers bundle themselves together. I think there's going to be some pretty cool stuff in that in the future.
I think so. That sounds great. In 3 years of Substack, you've seen a lot of newsletters being started. What would you say? Is there something that the financially most successful ones have in common?
Consistency is really good. It's really important that you show up and you keep publishing and you publish relatively frequently. That's common to the most successful ones. And then it's important for you as a publisher to, in the Substack world where your revenue comes from direct payments, to have an area, like a beat that you just completely own. You can write about this thing better than anyone else in the world. You've got a particular voice and worldview that attracts people. You might have domain expertise. Because in this world, and it doesn't matter how large your audience is. It matters how devoted your audience is. So your niche or your beat can be really defined, can be really narrow. And that can actually be an advantage. You're not trying to play the scale game where you're trying to reach the most giant possible audience in the hope that that might be monetized through ad impressions or something like that.
Do you have an example for that type of voice, like that type of niche publication?
Right, yeah. So one of the top newsletters on Substack, and the first one on Substack, is written by a guy named Bill Bishop, who's kind of an expert on China-US relationships, and every day publishes what is essentially an intelligence briefing sheet about the most important news of the day as it pertains to US-China relationships. So that's one that's a really good niche that he's carved out for himself. He just owns that area, and he's seen as the go-to guy for that kind of insight. There's another one that's called Petition, that's about the bankruptcy and turnaround restructuring distressed assets industry, which is not something that's particularly sexy, but is hard to get really quality journalism and insight and analysis about. And this is told in a really fun way, in a snarky tone with emojis. And then you get people also writing about model trains or their favorite books. And you can see such a huge variety of these publications on Substack and people writing about any area of interest, be it passion-based or business-based.
Real experts, right? Real expert views, being expressed in a unique sort of way to a very close group of readers. That brings me to my next questions. Just today, Anita Zelina, she is the Director of Strategic Initiatives at the Craig Newark Graduate School of Journalism, stated in a tweet that newsletters aren't perceived as content at all, but as a conversation with a human. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of looking at it. We often tell writers that the thing that they're selling with a subscription is not content. You're not paywalling content and hoping that people will pay to unlock content. They're really looking for a relationship with a writer who they trust or love and that they can help see the world through the eyes of. And so that conversation point is really relevant. Some people do just broadcast their posts and don't encourage interaction. But for the most part, the really top Substacks in particular have a lot of back and forth between the author and the reader. And sometimes that's in the private inbox where a reader might just reply to a post and say, hey, I love this. Or have you thought about it this way? And in some cases, it's actual comments on the posts. So Substack is, we kind of call it newsletters for shorthand, but there's a very strong web presence. And so these comments and discussion threads can happen on the website in public, either gated off just for the paying subscribers or open to everyone. And that is where a lot of the conversation can happen.
Let's get into the practicality, so to speak, because as you know, this podcast is part of an online course. So let's assume for a moment that I am CEO or editor-in-chief of an established newspaper or media brand. And let's say I want to be more like Substack, but I'm kind of caught up in path dependencies, so I cannot just completely pivot. Are there things where I could modernize my business model with something of a platform approach without building a completely new company? What are your thoughts on this?
I do think it's a challenge for existing media brands to just add on a Substack type approach and hope it's going to work. But I don't think it's impossible. I think there are interesting ways to explore what might work. For example, if I were a media brand, I would not just say, here's our main publication over here and it's monetized with ads and various other things and an events business. And by the way, you can go over here and get our special edition newsletter and that's going to cost you extra money. I think it's hard when people feel like they're paying for stuff already, that this is another thing for them to pay for on the side, because they feel like the business model is already baked in. But I do think it's really interesting if big media companies or established media companies pick a particular writer or perhaps a particular very narrow beat, but I think picking the writer, the personality, is more important, and giving them part ownership over a separate project that's removed from the normal activities of the business and the newsroom and is its own almost like skunk works or experimental type thing, where you just go deep on a particular issue with a particular voice. And the newspaper's brand, or the news organization's brand in this case, might be there, but should really be in the background, because what it should feel like is that the reader has that direct relationship with the writer who they trust. There is one example of this being done really well on Substack, and again, very, very early days, and I'm sure we'll see much more, but so Vice.com has a tech news vertical called Motherboard, and Motherboard has started a pop-up Substack publication that's all about the US Postal Service. It's written by the Star reporter named Aaron Gordon, and they're like, we're only going to do this for 3 months leading up to the election in the US. We're going to do deep dives into the US Postal Service. And if you subscribe, we're going to send you this physical zine, like a sort of hand-compiled mini publication. And the response to that has been really great. And I think it's because they had a very defined focus and they specifically built it around the voice of this trusted reporter.
So you mentioned the relationship as part of the building block or one of the crucial steps that a media company could take. What else is there? What other building blocks would you say are there if I wanted to become more like Substack, or if media companies wanted to become more like Substack?
You know, I'm not really sure that becoming more like Substack should be their goal. They should be themselves. but I think some of the insights that have served Substack well is to take it all back to basics. So a direct relationship, as we mentioned, between the reader and the writer, and not over-optimizing on things like design or like widgets and special technology gizmos. Instead, focus on doing great reporting and great writing and building those strong trust relationships with your readers. With Substack, you know, you can't choose what font you publish in. You can't center your text. There's still no way to add captions to your images. And yet, all these writers are happily pursuing work that they find really meaningful and getting paid directly and well by their readers. And I think it just goes to show you that the work and the relationship is, those are the most important elements. Is you could lose everything else and still have a successful media product that way. One of the promises we make to writers is that Substack will take care of everything except the hard part. And the hard part is the writing itself. The more you can free up your talent to focus on the writing and the reporting, the more strength you'll have. Writers should not have to be salespeople. They should not have to be marketers. They should not have to be technology experts. They shouldn't be trying to figure out how to make a mailing service play nicely with a web publishing service and then figuring out how to make a subscription payment tool work and then manage all their subscribers, all that trivia stuff, even the boring stuff around taxes and setting up an LLC, a limited liability company or any of that stuff. They shouldn't have to worry about that. We don't want them to worry about that. And we want to remove all that as much as possible so that they can just show up and put all of their focus and energy on doing the work that matters the most to the world. The ideal we shoot for is that you can be a writer and just come to Substack and type into this little box, hit publish, and the stories go out to the world and find the right people, and then money kind of magically appears in your bank account.
That sounds almost too good to be true.
So far, at the moment, it is too good to be true. That's what we're working towards. But we're certainly a lot closer to that now as a society than we were 3 years ago.
Now, what would you say? Can there be a future for media companies that stay on a more traditional path?
Traditional path, I think it can mean so many things. But there's certainly a role and a place and a lucrative one, I think, for the giants. So New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Der Spiegel. if you're a global news publication or you are the, like the dominant player in your nation and you are seen as the go-to source and you monetize with subscriptions, partly at least, I think those giants are going to endure. They're pretty solid. They're pretty robust. And then I think at the total other end of the spectrum are the kind of micro media empires that Substack is enabling. They will flourish, and over time they will rebundle and help fill out the middle class. But in the meantime, I think anything between those ends of the spectrum, if you're not a giant and you're not in the niche publishing space and like in part of the rebuilding of the ecosystem, then I think it's going to be very, very difficult. I think we're going to see a lot of shutdowns, closures, job losses. There's going to be a total reorganization. And I mean, that's not an insight. We're already seeing that. Like, that's happening.
Exactly. That is already happening. That's why a lot of great talent is moving to platforms like Substack, right? Casey Newton is the latest addition, and he's a very well-known journalist who has just announced that he's moving to Substack, in this case from The Verge. In your opinion, is there anything established companies can still hold on to that kind of talent? Or is it all independence all the way down?
Yes, there are some things they can do, but it's going to be difficult for the ones that are in this middle class that I described. The main thing they can do is pay their writers really well. Like, writers and reporters, like, their market value has been miscalculated for decades now. We're seeing that by the reporters and writers who jump to Substack and immediately double or triple their incomes. I think they can pay their writers really well. They could give them a share of the upside in the business. For example, maybe if they're doing subscriptions and a star writer is responsible for a good chunk of those subscriptions, that writer should get a chunk, like a piece of the subscription revenue, or they get equity in the company. I guess there are some like ethical boundaries to figure out around the separation of church and state. But, you know, I'm just putting on my hat here to try and think how the established companies might do their best to hold on to the talent. And otherwise, if I were running one of those companies, I would be looking at picking a few writers from my stable and giving them Substacks and letting them build their own audiences and being a good partner to them in building those audiences. So taking the company's big brand out of the focus, like putting that in the background, if at all in there, like the brand should be built around that individual writer, and then doing a generous revenue split with the writer. So, you know, maybe it's even 50-50. Like, you pay the writer's base salary, you pay them, you take care of their benefits and healthcare, etc. In the US is especially important. You give them that stability and the editing resources and legal resources that help them do the really difficult kind of reporting that they might hurt for if they were independent. And then you motivate them to build this product up as awesome as possible by letting them share in the upside. So they get a good chunk of the subscription revenue. They, you know, maybe they even own the mailing list. That will feel risky to some of these publications if they're doing that. But if the writer feels like this is something they own and it's the work that they're doing is accruing to them ultimately, then I think you might actually have a chance of keeping them. Whereas if they don't feel like it's something they own, then it's going to feel more to them like they don't have the stability and optionality that they would otherwise get through independence.
In your opinion, is there, in this ecosystem that you described with the giants and the individual writers, is there a place for smaller and local media companies as well?
Well, I think there's going to be new forms, new entities created, and local news will be part of what can be a reinvented ecosystem as well. We see some local news examples on Substack that are off to good starts. For example, there's a guy, Matt Elliott, who writes just about City Hall in Toronto. And there's a man, Tony Macia, who's hired a couple of people and covers business in Charlotte. And there's another guy in the UK who started a Manchester-focused news publication. And I think we'll see more and more entrepreneurial efforts around that. For the existing publications in local news and kind of similar circles from around local news, it's going to be really tough. And some of them will be able to be saved by, you know, wealthy philanthropists and the likes. But otherwise, if they just continue on the current trajectory, many of them are going to die. And I don't think we should just accept that. I don't think we can just let that happen. I think there has to be a radical reinvention. And that once a radical reinvention happens, then things can start to get better. But the longer we wait, the more pain we invite.
When you started out with Substack, I assume that, was it just you or were there other founders involved?
At the very, very start, it was me and one other, Chris Best, who's the brains of the operation. And then very early on, we were joined by a third founder, Jiraj Sethi, who's the chief technology officer. So Chris and Jiraj are both technical, and I'm not technical at all. I'm a journalist. And so I was in charge of talking to writers and helping them get interested in Substack and then helping them succeed on Substack. And the others were in charge of building the product and building the engineering infrastructure for Substack.
You are a writer. So was that your vision for Substack? Or do you feel like you're closer to your vision for Substack now?
The vision for Substack has stayed consistent, actually, since the day we launched the first publication, even before that. And it was hashed out between me and Chris, who's the CEO. And the reason we came to that, to believe in it, was there were a couple of examples out in the world of this particular model that Substack enables already succeeding. So Ben Thompson writes a publication called Stratechery, which is a hybrid of an email and web publication, and is, you know, his best stuff, it goes out for free on the web, and then paid subscribers, if they pay $100 a year, could get 3 more posts a week by email. And there are a couple others. The Timmerman Report was one by Luke Timmerman, who writes about biotech, and he was using a similar model. And what we thought about those publications was that they're great, and they're obviously working for those people. And Ben and Luke had both reported that they were making a good living from doing it. In fact, Ben Thompson, we figured at that point, was already making in the millions annual revenue, which is pretty good income for a single writer. But there was enough going on in the background. It was just too much of a barrier to entry for most writers. So you had to be technologically savvy enough to strap together these various tools that allowed you to publish to web and the email and accept payments. And most writers don't know how to do that, or just don't want to think about that or manage all the customer support that's involved with that. And most writers also aren't particularly business-minded and entrepreneurial in the sense of trying to figure out the economic models that can support this kind of work. And so we thought, well, if we can create a product that solves the technology problem and solves the business model problem, then we can dramatically lower the barrier to entry for writers to try this kind of thing. So then the only qualification for succeeding with this model would be a great writer.
After 3 years of Substack, what are your 3 best tips for business developers in media companies everywhere?
If I spent more time thinking about this, I might come up with slightly different answers. So I hope I'm not held throughout history to the responses I give here. But some very useful tips I can think from the top of my head is that you should control the relationship that you have with your audience. And in the Substack world, that means owning your mailing list and building your media empire around that mailing list, not relying on third parties and platforms, other platforms too much, so that you might be at the mercy of an algorithm change or a news feed or a reading environment that you're not in control of. If your year-long investigative feature, when it comes time to distribution, is just another little box in a Twitter feed that has to compete for people's attention with flame wars and hysteria, then you're not in a good place. So you want to own the relationship with your audience. In the Substack world, that's a mailing list that a writer controls. And in a larger company world, it should still be a mailing list. So I think that's my second point, is that email is probably the greatest media distribution tool ever invented. it's not owned by any one company and or controlled by any one company. It's free and relatively open, and almost every reading human on the planet has the email inbox icon on the home screen of their phone. So you actually have the best possible distribution app already installed on people's devices. And it's a push place, so you don't have to rely on people remembering to go back to check your website or refresh a feed. You have a way to reach those people who want it and who have trusted you enough to invite you into their inbox in a completionist way, so they can see everything that you choose to put in front of them. And then the other thing is that I think we should obliterate the media's dependence on ads. Advertising is a game already utterly won by Facebook and Google. And for as long as you rely on advertising as part of your business structure, you are going to be supplicant to Google and Facebook. And it's a game you can't win. And so you should play by a different set of rules. And payments, subscriptions is a much better set of rules, because then your customers are your readers, not an advertiser. And you have to serve your readers with quality by respecting their attention, by rewarding their trust. And if you can do those things, then they reward you and they have a happy relationship with you as their trusted source of information. And I think that's not only good for the businesses, but that's a much better way for the world to work, and that we can get out of this attention economy dominated situation where we spend all our lives being angry at each other for tweets and random decontextualized comments, where people are awarded internet points for the sharpest expressions of rage.
From your comments, I can absolutely hear like the appreciation that you have like for the readers, but also for the writers, obviously, who are doing the work. That's great. I'm actually through with my questions. Is there anything you would like to add?
One thing I'd like to say, I think, is that I hope and I believe that the media industry, or like the information system, or anyone who works in an area that involves kind of exchanging culture with each other, can get out of this defensive crouch where it feels like we're just trying to fend off death all the time. Because what we're seeing at Substack, and what like we fervently believe at Substack, because in part we've seen this, but just because we have these beliefs about the world, is that if we build a new ecosystem where ads aren't part of it and subscriptions are the fundamental thing that make the machine go, and then we use the power of the internet, we can create a new media ecosystem that is much better, much more lively, much richer, much more satisfying, much more valuable ultimately than anything we've seen before in the last few hundred years. I think this is the start of like in a tremendous period of innovation in media, and that like the first 30 years of the internet have kind of misled us. We've defaulted to advertising as being the business that supports good media, and it's led us to some dark places, and there's going to be a rebirth, and I think this is the start of it.
Wow. That's great. I'm glad that we can end on a positive note. Thank you so much, Hamish. That was so fascinating. I actually feel very inspired, and I think there were many great insights for media companies, not only in Germany, probably all around Europe. So thank you very, very much. It was a pleasure to meet you, and I hope that we get to talk very soon again. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I really appreciate your interest.
Und damit endet diese Folge des Media Lab Innovation Podcasts auch schon wieder. Noch mehr Folgen, auch zum Thema Business Model, findet ihr überall, wo es Podcasts gibt. Und noch weitere Infos findet ihr auf www.media-lab.de. Schaut doch mal rein. Bis dahin, macht's gut und bleibt innovativ.